Greetings and welcome to episode 13 of Theology and Sci-Fi, the podcast. I am your host, Derek V. Trout, and I'm so thankful that you have decided to join me today for the last episode of season one. Yes, we are done with season one after this podcast. So for season two, not much is going to change, but instead of looking at movies and novels, what we're going to do is we're simply going to look at short stories and individual TV show episodes. There's a lot of great short stories out there that are science fiction. There's a lot of great TV shows out there that are science fiction. And instead of looking at the whole series of a TV show, we're just going to pick individual standalone episodes, and we're going to look at those. So I'm excited to dive into some TV shows that are really great in the sci-fi world, and also we're going to do that with some short stories. So it's still going to be the same kind of thing. We're just going to transition from movies and books to TV shows and short stories. So it is going to be a season of shorts, is what I'm calling it, a season of shorts. And the first episode of season two will be on July 14th. I've got some things going on in June, kind of busy, I got a lot of stuff going on, so I'm going to take a break for a little while. So July 14th, I don't know what I just said for the date that this is going to be released, but July 14th will be when season two of Theology and Sci-Fi comes out, and we'll be looking at short stories and TV show episodes, and I'll post social media and such which ones we'll be doing and what direction we'll be going with that. So I'm looking forward to be back in July with looking at TV shows and short stories. That'll be the plan going forward. But today, we turn back to the printed word to examine what is considered by many to be the first science fiction book, Frankenstein by Mary Shelley. And before this episode, I had never read this book. I had seen other works about Frankenstein, but this book is my favorite Frankenstein work in any format, whether we're looking at a TV show, whether we're looking at a movie, whether we're looking at a short story that's kind of a retelling or a book, whatever it may be, this is my favorite Frankenstein. But I have a question for you. Is this the first science fiction book? What do you think? I know there's some debate about that, whether Frankenstein is the first science fiction book or not. I think it clearly falls under science fiction. It's very science-y, and Frankenstein is into science and creates the monster. That's a misconception about this book now. Frankenstein, we think of as the monster. Frankenstein is not the monster. Frankenstein is the one who makes the monster, if we can even call him a monster, which we'll look at throughout this book and see if we can. But Frankenstein is not the creature that is created. It is the one who creates the creature. And so that's just a little bit different that sometimes people go, well, Frankenstein is now known as the monster, not as the creator. But originally, Frankenstein's the creator, not the what is created. But anyway, this is a really good book. I enjoyed it, and something that I'm really looking forward to discussing here. And so let's get started. First of all, this book was published in 1818, so it was published a while ago. I think this is by far the oldest work that we've looked at, but it still carries over really well. The book was written by Mary Shelley, who was only 20 at the time of publication, and the first published, the first edition of this novel was published anonymously. Her name was not on it, I would assume, because she was a female in 1818 writing a book. They probably did not want her name put on it, would be my assumption. But by 1821, her name was on it. So only a few years later, 3 years later, that they did put her name on it. So 1821 is one of the first attributed to Mary Shelley, as it should have always been. Pretty impressive that Mary Shelley was only 20 when this was published. So she must have obviously been much younger when it was actually written, and something that I truly enjoyed this book. Of course, as we get into this, there will be spoilers to follow. I don't think I should have to give a spoiler warning on something that was written in 1818, over 200 years ago, but nonetheless, a spoiler has been given. So many spoilers to follow as we get into this. So the book starts with, it started kind of strange for me. I wasn't sure really where it was going. By the end, it made sense. So the book starts with somebody writing letters, a Captain Robert Walton. He's writing letters, and he has set out to explore the North Pole in hopes of gaining some kind of scientific knowledge and understanding. So he sets out on a scientific expedition to the North Pole and doing some research, trying to gain some knowledge. But during the visit, during the voyage, the crew spots a dog sled with a very large person who was with them. And they try to follow, and they're wondering what's going on here. But a few hours later, the crew rescues nearly a frozen and a man who is near death. His name is Victor Frankenstein. So Frankenstein is the creator of what's known as, you know, Frankenstein's monster. He's the creator of that, not actually the monster in this work, but he's become the monster over, you know, over the years of this story. Just a really interesting transition, I think. But so Frankenstein's been in pursuit of this giant man that they have seen, that Walton's crew has seen. And then so they go and they save him, and that's kind of the opening of that. That they go and they, you know, Frankenstein's chasing after this giant man, and they go and they rescue him and they save him. So I didn't really know kind of where this was going when it started out. I thought it was a really interesting way to start, and wasn't sure where it was going. But from those opening letters, actually, there's actually something that I wanted to read that I thought was worth discussing, and this is from letter 4 here. So here's what it says. And this is a Walton writing here. The stranger, which is Frankenstein, this Victor Frankenstein, not the monster, but it's Frankenstein. So that's probably going to be something confusing throughout this podcast, where I'm probably going to refer to Frankenstein. Well, I'm going to refer to Frankenstein as Victor Frankenstein, the creator of the monster. And when we're talking about the monster, I'll just say Frankenstein's monster. And anyway, that might be confusing, but hopefully not. So the stranger, who is Frankenstein, has gradually improved in health, but is very silent and appears uneasy when anyone except myself enters the cabin. Yet his manners are so conciliating and gentle that the sailors are all interested in him, although they have had very little communication with him. For my own part, I began to love him as a brother, and his constant and deep grief fills me with sympathy and compassion. He must have been a noble creature in his better days, being even now in wreck, so attractive and amiable. So here what we see is Walton accepting a stranger that he doesn't know, that he's rescued from the ice, that is near death. They come and they accept him, and they bring him a part of their crew. And what it just reminded me of is the acceptance that we should have for others. Again, we've talked on here before that just because we accept others does not mean that we accept everything they do. Jesus tells us to accept people, to welcome them into his family. But once the people are welcomed into the family of God, then there's expectations. There's things that have to change. There's sin that we're doing that needs to stop. There's certain things that Jesus expects us to do once we accept that invitation into his family. Jesus loves us so much that he wants to accept us into his family, but he also loves us so much that he doesn't want us to stay where we are doing sin and harmful things that will hurt us and others. So Jesus will accept us, but he doesn't want us to stay where we've been, living in a sinful lifestyle. He doesn't want us to stay there, even though he accepts us into his family. He expects change to happen after that. So anyway, the acceptance of Frankenstein stands out to me, but it also made me think of the Good Samaritan and that story, how somebody just offers help. Somebody who shouldn't offer help. It's, you know, the people who are different and people who can be separated from different things, but they still go and offer help. So it just reminded me of what we should do and how we should treat people with compassion and sympathy and empathy. I really like that part here. I think it's just really good writing. This whole book is written so well. So I thought that was just worth mentioning, those ideas of acceptance and the Good Samaritan idea that comes from that I think that we see here with Walton and his crew. So the first section kind of leaves things unresolved, really. We know that Frankenstein has been rescued by this crew, and then Victor Frankenstein begins to tell. So we kind of start at the end of the story, or close to the end of the story, and then we back up and kind of tell how we've gotten to this point, to where Frankenstein has been rescued by Walton and his crew. So that's kind of why it's unresolved in this first part, because we back up and then start from the beginning. So the next section goes into Victor Frankenstein's telling of the story and telling of what happened. So we start out with Walton telling a little bit, and it's not very long. But then we start out with Victor Frankenstein, and then we move to Victor Frankenstein telling his story. And then we actually have Frankenstein's monster telling some of the story. And then we go back to Victor Frankenstein telling the story. And then we end again with Captain Walden, which is why that makes sense at the end. We come back to him at the end. So that's kind of the flow that goes through here. So in Frankenstein's narrative, he begins by telling of his childhood and what had happened. And that he has younger brothers, Ernest and William, and they're the sons of Alphonse Frankenstein and Carolyn Beaufort Frankenstein. So from a young age, Victor has a strong desire to understand the world. He wants to understand things that are going on around him and things that are happening. He wants to be able to understand the world and things in there. Here's what we read to go along with that idea. It was the secrets of heaven and earth that I desired to learn, and whether it was the outward substance of things or the inner spirit of nature and the mysterious soul of man that occupied me, still, my inquiries were distracted to the metaphysical, or in its highest sense, the physical secrets of the world. So Frankenstein is looking for some kind of secret, some kind of knowledge that he can gain. He wants to understand everything that he can possibly understand and to be able to do that. So we see Frankenstein there looking for this. And what struck me about this, he's looking for the secrets of heaven and earth. I'm not really sure there are secrets to heaven. God has revealed his plan. At one time, obviously, it was not revealed and not completely understood. But now, living in the time that we are, Jesus has came. He's revealed who God is and how we can have salvation. So I don't think there really are these secrets of heaven. Sometimes you hear about people having secret knowledge or things like that. God doesn't give secret knowledge to people now. He's given a revelation of who he is in the scripture so that everyone can see it. So if someone comes to you and says, I have some secret knowledge about God and what he's done, and if those are contrary, especially if those are contrary to the scriptures, we know that that knowledge is not from God, because God has revealed who he is and has made his plan visible so that all can see. So I'm not really sure if Frankenstein is going to find what he's looking for, because I don't think there is anything to find there. So Frankenstein is obsessed with trying to understand the world and all there is to it. And he looks at some theories and he thinks it may be out of date, and he wants to learn some new things. And he's looking at alchemists and all these different kinds of things that he considers to be outdated, and something that he thinks that he can find that will be new, something he thinks that he can find that will be better. But why does Frankenstein want all of this knowledge? What exactly is he looking for? And we read that in chapter 2. Here is part of what we read. Under the guidance of my new preceptors, I entered with the greatest diligence into the search of the Philosopher's Stone and the Elixir of Life. But the latter soon obtained my undivided attention, the Elixir of Life. Wealth was an inferior object, but what glory would attain the discovery? If I could banish disease from the human frame and render man invulnerable to any but a violent death. So Frankenstein asks here, what glory would attend the discovery? What glory would attend the discovery? He's looking for the glory of people. He's looking to have fame. He doesn't necessarily care about the wealth, but he wants the glory that can come from this great scientific discovery of being able to give the elixir of life, or to bring the dead back to life. What Frankenstein is hoping to do is what only God can do. So we'll see that throughout the novel, and we'll get into that Frankenstein is trying to play the part of God. He is trying to be God. And we'll see that as we go out. But that's what this is, that he wants to bring the dead back to life. Where have we heard that before? And who is the only one who can do that? That power belongs to God and God alone, but Frankenstein wants that power. He wants to be godlike. And along with that, he also wants the praise of the people. He wants people to praise him. He wants the glory that will come along with that. Glory that and praise should only be given to God. He wants that as well. So I think that Frankenstein throughout this is really trying to be God. That's what he wants. He wants to be God. Well, about the idea of people's praise and following after that, we're going to read 1 Thessalonians 2, 1 through 8. You know, brothers and sisters, that our visit to you was not without results. We had previously suffered and been treated outrageously in Philippi. As you know, but with the help of our God, we dared to tell you his gospel in the face of strong opposition. For the appeal we make does not spring from error or impure motives, nor are we trying to trick you. On the contrary, we speak as those approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. We are not trying to please people, but God, who tests our hearts. You know we never use flattery, nor do we put on a mask to cover up greed. God is our witness. We are not looking for praise from people, not from you or anyone else. Even though as apostles of Christ, we could have asserted our authority. Instead, we were like young children among you. Just as a nursing mother cares for her children, so we cared for you, because we loved you so much. We were delighted to share with you not only the gospel of God, but our lives as well. So here in Thessalonians, we read about how they were not looking for the praise from people. They weren't looking for praise from you or from anyone else. That's not who the people here were looking for. That's not those who are spreading the gospel we're looking for. They don't want that praise, because that should not be our motivation in doing things. So Frankenstein here is saying, why does he want to discover this elixir of life? Why does he want this godlike power to get the praise from people? So he doesn't necessarily, you know, if he can cure all disease, he says at one point, you know, if I can could banish disease from the human frame, why does he want to do that? For the good of humanity, so that people can recover, so that people aren't sick and people aren't ill and people aren't dying? No, he wants to do it so that you can get some glory from it. He's chasing after glory. So some people in this world chase after, you know, a relationship with the right person, or they chase after wealth, or they chase after things, or they chase after a position or whatever it may be. But what Frankenstein is chasing after is glory. He wants that recognition. He wants people to know how great he is. He's chasing after that. But we as Christians, we should not be seeking our own glory. We should be seeking to glorify God. We should be seeking to glorify God, giving the praise and glory to God for the things that happen in our lives. But Frankenstein here, he is not looking for God's glory. He is looking to be God-like and to receive that glory. And how many of us are doing that in our daily lives, if we're going to be honest with ourselves? Trying to put ourselves in the place of God, deciding what we will do and what we will not do, trying to decide what is best for us, what we want to follow, and trying to maybe get some glory for things that we do well. How many of us are trying to be God-like? I think that's maybe, if we're going to be honest with ourselves, more than we would like to admit. But we need to let God take his rightful place in our lives and not try to take that from him, as Frankenstein, I believe, is doing here. Also in this first section here, where we look at Frankenstein's narrative for the first time, we see that when Victor is 5, his parents adopt Elizabeth, who is Frankenstein's cousin. So that is Victor Frankenstein's cousin. It's his aunt's daughter. So it's his cousin, but things were different in 1812, because eventually they do get engaged. So he does get engaged to his cousin, like his first cousin. And we've talked about things like that before in here, so you can go back and look at other previous episodes if you want to know more about that. So they adopt Elizabeth, somebody that is his cousin that he later goes on to be engaged to. So we'll get there a little bit later. So as Frankenstein is preparing to go to university, at the University of Ingolstadt, I don't know if I'm saying that right, a university in Germany, his mother dies of scarlet fever. And so Victor, in his grief, just commits himself to his work and to his experiments. It's his way of kind of escaping and forgetting about what has happened, and letting go is just being obsessive, being solely focused on his work and what he wants to do. So he, you know, is looking at chemistry and other sciences that he's doing really well at, and soon develops a secret method. And we're not really told what this method is, because it doesn't really matter. because we're in the world of fiction, so we can go kind of whatever way we want with this. But he develops a secret technique to impart life to non-living matter, to reanimate the dead, to bring those who are dead back to life. So he is able to develop that secret. And here's what we read in one part about this, and kind of just the effect that this is having on him, just being obsessed with his work and going through these. And here's where we see something here, that Frankenstein really truly has no hope, and also he has no hope, and just how much this is kind of taken, this kind of work has kind of taken him to a really, really dark place. We read this here. This is in chapter 4. Darkness had no effect upon my fancy, and a churchyard was to me merely the receptacle of bodies deprived of life, which from being the seat of beauty and strength had become food for the worm. He seems to have no hope here. He doesn't look at things. So Frankenstein, I don't think that he would believe that there is an afterlife. He just looks at when people have died, all they do is go and become food for the worm, and it doesn't really bother him anymore. He's not really upset by death. But there's also, because this is his work, and he thinks that he can reverse that, and he believes that is possible and that he can do that. So he comes here and he is really not bothered by death anymore, but doesn't see any hope beyond death either, which may be part of the reason for his work here, that since he has no hope, since he doesn't believe in a hope of the afterlife, he has to try to reanimate people, has to try to bring them back from the dead. And when we talk about bringing people back from the dead, we're not talking about, somebody has, been in some kind of accident, or something has happened and they do CPR and bring them back, and they've been dead for 2 minutes or whatever. No, we're not talking about that. We're talking about people that have been dead, for a long time. That have been dead for days or weeks, whatever it may be, people that have been dead for a very long time that Frankenstein can reanimate and bring back to life. So something that goes beyond medical explanation is what we're looking at here. And we talk about him bringing life to non-living matter. So Frankenstein truly wants to be God, to be able to give life. God is the giver of life. God is the source of life. He's the one who breathes life into Adam's lungs in creation. He is the giver and source of life, and that's what Frankenstein wants to do. He wants to be godlike. He wants to have God's power. And I think it stems perhaps in part from him having no hope, from him not knowing who God is and not having the hope that Jesus brings, hope that this world's not the only world, that this life's not the only life. We have hope in this life with Jesus, but we also have hope for the next life. And continuing in chapter 4, we really see that Frankenstein wants to be like God, that he wants to, that he talks about him creating a human being, that's what he's looking forward to, and that's what he wants to do, to create a human being, to give life to that which has no life. And here's what we read in one paragraph in chapter 4. No one can conceive the variety of feelings which bore me onwards like a hurricane in the first enthusiasm of success. Life and death appeared to me idle bounds, which I should first break through and pour a torrent of light into our dark world. A new species would bless me as its creator and source. Many help and excellent natures would owe their being to me. No father could claim the gratitude of his child so completely as I should deserve theirs. Pursuing these reflections, I thought that if I could bestow animation upon lifeless matter, I might, in a process of time, although I now found it impossible, renew life where death had apparently devoted the body to corruption. So he's looking to bring people back to life. That's what he wants to do. He wants to play that part of God. He wants to be God. That's what he wants to do, to be able to give life, something that belongs, a power that only belongs to God, to be able to give life, and to give life from nothing. So that's what I'm talking about here. Two people can come together and create a new child and create life, but we create from something. We create from matter. We create from things that are already living. to be able to make that life. But what God does is take something, matter that has no life, and can make it alive. That's what I'm talking about here. And that's what Frankenstein wants to be able to do. And he also wants to be able to get that glory. We see that again. No father could claim the gratitude of his child so completely as I should deserve theirs. Talking about bringing people back to life. He again wants that glory. He wants that recognition. He wants that praise from people. That is what carries him on. That is what he wants. And by chapter 5, we see Frankenstein and his creature, Frankenstein's monster, come to life. Here's what we read in the beginning of chapter 5. It was on a dreary night of November that I beheld the accomplishment of my toils. With an anxiety that almost amounted to agony, I collected the instruments of life around me that I might infuse a spark of being into the lifeless thing that lay at my feet. It was already 1 a.m. The rain padded dismally against the panes, and my candle was nearly burnt out, when by the glimmer of the half-extinguished light, I saw the dull yellow eye of the creature open. It breathed hard and convulsed. Motion agitated its limbs. It's alive. So we see here that Frankenstein's monster has come to life. That struck me as funny, kind of the irony here that Frankenstein has been able to give life to that which is lifeless. He has discovered this power and set something up to give this kind of ability, but he has to rely on the light of a candle. I thought that was funny. Still doesn't have electricity, it would seem, but is reanimating the dead. I just thought that was funny. Anyway, so Frankenstein, the creature is very large. He's about 8 feet tall. Frankenstein has to make him very big and very large because there's some very complex parts of people, right? We are complex in our composition. So making them bigger makes it easier to fit all those kinds of parts together and to be able to do that. So about this creature too, we read that he has yellow skin. His yellow skin scarcely covered the work of muscle and arteries beneath. His hair was a lustrous black and flowing, his teeth pearly whiteness. But these luxuries only framed a more horrid contrast with his watery eyes that seemed almost of the same color as the dune white sockets in which they were set, his shriveled complexion and straight black lips. So it'd be pretty simple to see Frankenstein's monster, this big 8 foot tall creature with yellow skin and not really the way that we kind of picture Frankenstein either. We think of him as green these days, but he has yellow skin that you can kind of see his veins and arteries underneath his skin that's flowing through here. So it would have been a very noticeable creature, but that which is not alive to life. And you would think that maybe Frankenstein would be happy about this, something that he's worked his whole life to be able to do, something that he would celebrate with, something that he would really like and enjoy. But no, he sees what he's created and it terrifies him. He's repulsed by this and he actually runs away. He flees. He leaves. And he leaves the monster. And then the next day, he meets his childhood friend, Henry Clerval. And he takes Clerval back to see the monster that he has made. Clerval was a childhood friend, and he meets him again. And they when he goes back there, he's fearful of what Clerval will think. He doesn't know what he's going to think about this monster. I'm not sure that Frankenstein even knows what to think about this monster here. But however, when Frankenstein returns to his laboratory, the creature is gone. He has left. He's not there anymore. He has escaped, and they don't know where he is. They don't know where he's gone. And then Victor falls ill from this experience, but he's nursed back to health by Clerval. And so after recovery, his father sends him a letter that his brother, that Frankenstein's brother William, has been murdered. Somebody has killed his brother. And upon returning to where he grew up, his childhood home, Victor sees his creature that he has created near the crime scene. He sees him near the crime scene, and he becomes convinced that Frankenstein, that his monster, is responsible for killing his brother. He becomes convinced that that's who did it, even though Justine Moritz, who was another child that Victor's family had adopted, but she became a nanny, and she became William's nanny. So she is found near the body, and they're convinced that she's the one who killed William. That they believe that she's the one who did that. So she's found with William's locket, contains a portrait of his mother. So it's found in her pocket. So she had something of William's, and she was his caretaker, and she was with him, and she was around at that time. So they thought that it was her who had killed her, even though Frankenstein knows who it is. Frankenstein knows it's this, he believes that it's this monster that he created, and he's correct, it was. He believes that it's the monster that he created that has killed his brother, but yeah, he feels like he can't tell anyone because he doesn't want anyone to know that he's created this monster. He thought that he would love to reanimate the dead. He thought that he would love to give life to that which is not living, and would receive glory from it, and would receive praise, and people would love him, and he did, you know, but now, once he's actually seen that, once he's actually done that, he's repulsed by it. He doesn't want anything more to do with it. He doesn't want people to know that that creature is there, and that that creature is alive, and that he created it. So he can't tell people. He can't tell people, no, it wasn't the nanny. It wasn't Justine who killed William, but it was this monster that I created. He can't do that. He can't bring himself to say that. So Justine is put on trial. She is put on trial for this murder, and it comes that she is found guilty. But of course she wasn't. She was innocent. She was found guilty of the death of William and was hung for that, hung for being convicted a murderer, and is hung. But she was innocent. Of course, that reminds me of somebody else who was innocent and died as well. Jesus. In John 18:33-40, we read this. Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus, and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" So this is after Jesus has been arrested, after he's been taken captive, and he's under, the Jews take him to Pilate because they want to crucify Jesus, and they can't do it according to their own laws, so they need to go and get some outside help from the Romans. So they go and they go to ask Pilate this. So Pilate's trying to do some investigation to see, well, what has Jesus done that is worthy of being killed? What has he done? What is his crime? What is he being accused of? So in John 18:33-40 again, Pilate then went back inside the palace, summoned Jesus, and asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "Is that your own idea?" Jesus asked, "or did others talk to you about me?" "Am I a Jew?" Pilate replied. "Your own people and chief priests handed you over to me. What is it that you have done?" And Jesus said, "My kingdom is not of this world. If it were, my servants would fight to prevent my arrest by the Jewish leaders. But now my kingdom is from another place." "Then you are a king," Pilate said. Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. In fact, the reason I was born and came to this world is to testify to the truth. Everyone on the side of the truth listens to me." "What is truth?" retorted Pilate. With this, he went out into the Jews gathered there, and he said, "I find no basis for a charge against him. But it is your custom for me to release to you one prisoner at the time of the Passover. Do you want me to release the king of the Jews?" They shouted back, "No, not him. Give us Barabbas." Now Barabbas had taken part in an uprising. So they asked for the release of Barabbas, but here Pilate can find nothing. "I find no basis for a charge against him." That Jesus dies, that Jesus is innocent when he is sentenced to be crucified. Jesus is innocent. Here in the book, we see that Justine is innocent. She did not do anything to William to harm him or to kill him, but she is innocent and is found guilty and then ultimately dies, even though she truly wasn't guilty. So Jesus, here, he is accused of many different things. He's accused of blasphemy or accused of all these different things because he claims to be the Son of God. That's who he is. So he is not blaspheming. And other things go into to why the Pharisees wanted Jesus to die. But Jesus dies innocently. He had not broken any of God's laws. He had not sinned against God. He had not done any of those things to deserve death. Now, he might have broken some human laws, right? So during the time, I don't know, some human laws, though, are not God's laws. You know, being in the Roman Empire, having to say that Caesar is Lord, if that's the human law, that goes against God's law. So maybe you could say that Jesus would have done that, but Pilate doesn't find any reason to say that. So Jesus says nothing that's deserving of death, whether it's from a moral sin perspective or whether it's from the government perspective. Pilate, I find no basis for a charge against him. Jesus is completely innocent. He is innocent, and yet he dies anyway. He dies innocently. Justine here is innocent. It is the Frankenstein's monster who has committed this crime, but yet she is the one who pays for it. In a similar way, we are the one who have sinned. People have sinned. We are the ones who deserve the punishment, but Jesus has paid for it. He suffers innocently. He dies innocently. But he pays for our guilt. That's what Jesus does. Pays for our guilt in his death so that we can be forgiven and enter into right relationship with God. So looking here at Justine and what happens, she dies even though she is innocent. Jesus died even though he was innocent to be able to forgive us, to be able to take so that we could be forgiven, so that we could be restored to a right relationship with God as he takes our sin upon him, as he takes our sin upon him and dies for us. So Frankenstein has a lot of regret. He's made this monster. He's seen what it is. He's appalled by it. And then it's gone and has killed his brother. He has a lot of regret here, and he's not sure what he can do to really redeem himself. So at one point here in chapter 9, we read this. Thus not the tenderness of friendship, nor the beauty of earth, nor of heaven could redeem my soul from woe. The very accents of love were ineffectual. So he's here and he's looking and he's asking, what can redeem me? How can I be redeemed for this great evil that I have done? Friends, sometimes we ask ourselves that question as well. Could God really love me? Could God really redeem me? Could he really make me right after all the things that I have done? You don't know what I've done. I've done some really terrible things. I've heard people say that before. Could God still love me? Could God still forgive me? The simple answer to that is yes. Yes. That Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us, for it is written, cursed is everyone who is hung on a pole. He redeemed us in order that the blessing given to Abraham might come to the Gentiles through Jesus Christ, so that by faith we might receive the promise of the Spirit. And that's Galatians 3:13-14. That Jesus redeems us. He makes us right what we've done, and he could have redeemed Frankenstein and what he had done wrong. That Jesus has that capability through his birth, life, death, resurrection, and ascension. Jesus redeems us. He can let us enter into right relationship with God, and the things that we have done, the sins that we have committed, can be forgiven. But here Frankenstein seems to think that he has no hope on not the beauty of earth nor of heaven could redeem my soul from woe. He's wrong. It can. Jesus can do that when we turn to him. He can redeem us, can restore us. So if you need to be restored today, if you need something to be forgiven or to be let free of guilt and shame and pain, turn to Jesus. He can and will and does redeem those who turn to him. So Victor is crushed. He is guilty. He feels like he is responsible for his brother's death because the creature that he has created is the one who killed his brother. So he goes to the mountains. He goes to get away. And in going there, he goes and he meets his monster. Frankenstein's monster comes and he talks to him. And here's some of what we read here in chapter 10. From this discussion here. And here's what we read, part of what Frankenstein's monster says to Frankenstein. Be calm, I entreat you to hear me before you give vent to your hatred on my devoted head. Have I not suffered enough that you seek to increase my misery? Life, although it may only be an accumulation of anguish, is dear to me, and I will defend it. I think life is more than that. Life is more than just an accumulation of anguish. Maybe that's what you've thought it's been. Maybe that's what you think it is. Maybe that's what you think it's going to be. But when we turn to Jesus, we can have life and have life more abundantly. Life and life more abundantly, both in this world and in the world to come. Again, though, Jesus never promises us that we will have an easy life. He promises that he'll be with us through life. So in those uneasy times, those things that we go through, Jesus is going to be with us. When we do have anguish, we have someone to cast our cares upon. When we do go through times that are difficult, we have somebody who comes and walks beside us and is still there with us in those difficult times that make it so that we can get through those. So I would say that life is more than just an accumulation of anguish. And if it has been that for you, if that is your feeling, if that's what you think, I invite you, I challenge you to turn to Jesus, to look to him. Look to him to cast your cares upon. Look to him to walk through these things with. Life can be more than just a series of accumulated anguish. But in this conversation, Frankenstein's monster also says this to Frankenstein. Remember that I am thy creature. I ought to be thy Adam. But I am rather the fallen angel, whom thou drivest from joy for no misdeed. Everywhere I see bliss, from which I alone am irrevocably excluded. I was benevolent and good. Misery made me a fiend. Make me happy, and I shall again be virtuous. Be gone, this is what Frankenstein says. Be gone, I will not hear you. There can be no community between you and me. We are enemies. Be gone. Or let us try our strength in a fight in which one must fall. How can I move thee? This is what Frankenstein's monster replies. How can I move thee? Will no entreaties cause thee to turn a favorable eye upon thy creature, whom implores thy goodness and compassion? Believe me, Frankenstein, I was benevolent. My soul glowed with love and humanity, but am I not alone? Miserably alone. You, my creator, abhor me. What hope can I gather from your fellow creatures? You owe me nothing. They spurn and hate me. They descend mountains and dreary glaciers. Oh my goodness, I need to learn to read. All right, let's just start all that again. Frankenstein's monster replies, how can I move thee? Will no entreaties cause thee to turn a favorable eye upon thy creature who implores thy goodness and compassion? Believe me, Frankenstein, I was benevolent. My soul glowed with love and humanity, but am I not alone? Miserably alone. You, my creator, abhor me. What hope can I gather from your fellow creatures who owe me nothing? They spurn and hate me. The desert mountains and dreary glaciers are my refuge. So Frankenstein here confronts his creator and asks him, why does he hate him so much? Why can he not accept him? Why do they have to be enemies? Why can they not get along? Can there not be any kind of compassion? Can there not be any kind of goodness that Frankenstein has for his creature? Frankenstein doesn't feel that. But friends, that is not the way it is between God and his creation. See, we are God's creation. Everything that we see here in this world, we as people, we are God's creation. And God has not rejected us. God has not forsaken us. God does not abhor us. No, that is not who God is. But even in our fallenness, even in our sin, even in our mistakes, God still loves us. God loves his creation. He cares for his creation. He has given compassion and goodness to his creation. He sends his son. He sends Jesus to save his creation. God loves us so much. Here Frankenstein rejects what he has made. He doesn't like it. I wonder why he doesn't like it. Oh, this just dawned upon me. I wonder why he doesn't like it. Is it be, Is it because he killed his brother? I think that's part of it, but I wonder what. But even before Frankenstein's monster killed his brother, he didn't like it. He didn't like his creation. He didn't like what he had made. He didn't like the way that it looked. I wonder if Frankenstein saw something in himself, in his creation, that made him not like it. I wonder if that's it. That just dawned upon me. What is it that caused him to run away? The look of this creature? Surely that has something to do with it. It's terrifying looking, but I wonder what it was. Could Frankenstein just not deal with this power that he had that he was never supposed to have to begin with? Did he see something in this creature? Or does he come to see something in this creature that he sees in himself that causes him to not like it? I'm not sure. But Frankenstein comes to not like his creation, to not want to have anything to do with his creation, to just want to leave his creation alone and not have to deal with that, not have to have things be a concern and a bother for him. But that is not the way that it is with God. God cares for his creation. He is active in creation. He cares for us, and he is present with us, and he has sent his son to save us. God does not just create and take his hand off everything and say, okay, now you're on your own. I don't want anything to do with you. That's what Frankenstein has done. Frankenstein has kind of a, what we would call, since Frankenstein is trying to play a god, if we were to look at Frankenstein as someone who is godlike, he would be a deistic god. He would be what we call deism, which states that there is a god who created and established natural laws and then leaves. He doesn't want anything else to do with it. He's created and he's good with it. And now that he's created, he just wants nothing else to do with it. That's deism. And that's what Frankenstein would be. He has created this monster. And now he wants nothing to do with it. He just wants to leave once he's created, and whatever will be, will be. But that is not who God is. God creates and he cares for his creation. He is active in creation. He loves his creation. He has sent people to on his behalf to tell of his love for his creation. He has sent the prophets and he sent people from the Old Testament. And that ultimately comes in his son Jesus that he sends to be able to tell us how much he loves us and to demonstrate that through his life, death, and resurrection. So Frankenstein here wants to be loved by his creator. Friends, we are already loved by our creator. He already has compassion and goodness upon us and wants to be in a relationship with us. He does not want to reject us as Frankenstein wants to reject his monster. God does not want to reject us. He wants to be in relationship with us, and he wants to be in right relationship with us. So the relationship that God wants to have with his creation is quite different than the relationship that Frankenstein wants to have with his creation. Again, Frankenstein here has tried to play God, but he simply could not do it because he is not God. He tried to be God, but he's not God. Maybe there's a lesson that we can learn in there as well, that we need to let God be God because we are not. In the next few chapters, we move to Frankenstein's monster's point of view. So Frankenstein's monster begs Frankenstein to tell him his story, and Frankenstein says that he will listen to the monster's story. So the creature tells of his first days of life, how he lived in the wilderness and was out on his own, and he found people that again didn't like him, that were afraid of him because of his appearance. So he had to run, he had to hide from people. He didn't want people to see who he was or what he looked like, because it was frightening to people. So he lives in an abandoned structure that's connected to a cottage where there's a family that lives, and he grows very fond of this family. Almost, they don't know that he's there, but he knows that they're there, and he takes comfort from that, and he wants to be a part of this family. He so desperately wants to be with them. But so he secretly is living next to this cottage for months, and he actually learns how to speak by listening to the people that are speaking in this cottage. And he learns how to read by discovering some lost books that are in the woods, and this family is reading and they have children who are reading. So he actually learns how to speak and how to read by kind of being with this family, even though they don't really know that he is there. But when he sees his reflection also at one point in a pool, and he realizes that his appearance is terrifying, his appearance horrifies him. He's horrified by his appearance just as much as other people are. that he looks there and he doesn't like what he sees in that reflection of that pool, which I think also kind of leads to this great dislike of his creator, because he doesn't like how he was created, I think might have something to do with that. So he continues to get attached to this family that he's living with. He eventually, at one point, approaches them. He decides to reveal, not that he's been living next to them and they didn't know about that, but just tries to reveal himself and wants to befriend the family. But of course, they are terrified by him. They are horrified by him. The father of the family is blind, so he doesn't know anything until the other people of the house come in, and they are just terrified by him, and they're frightened, and Frankenstein has to leave. And the next day, the family, Frankenstein leaves, knows that he won't be accepted by him, but thinks he can just go back and live in this abandoned place next to this cottage. But the next day, the family leaves their home and says that they're not going to come back, that they're not going to come back. So again, Frankenstein feels abandoned. He feels like there's nobody there that can care for him, that will care about him. He feels abandoned, and he really feels lonely, which is again a common theme that we have seen throughout science fiction, people feeling lonely, being lonely. But we've seen earlier that Frankenstein said that he had a human soul, that he had a gentleness, that he wasn't always this, you know, monster that's now bent on revenge. And we actually see that at one point with this family that he's at there, that he, well, here's what Frankenstein says at one point, this is in chapter 12, about living next to this family. They often, I believe, suffered the pangs of hunger very poignantly, especially the two younger cottagers. For several times, they placed food before the old man when they reserved none for themselves. So the children are letting their father eat, who is blind. This trait of kindness moved me sensibly. I had been accustomed during the night to steal a part of their store for my own consumption. So he was stealing their food to be able to eat. But when I found that in doing this, I inflicted pain on the cottagers, I abstained and satisfied myself with berries, nuts, and roots, which I gathered from a neighboring wood. So Frankenstein here thinks that he's doing no harm, taking their food and eating it. He's watching them. He sees them. This is what they do, and he needs to eat. But once he realizes he is doing harm to them, once he realizes that this is having an impact upon them, he stops. So he's kind of learning even what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. He's kind of learning what is right and what is wrong throughout this. But looking at this and seeing this and then stopping this, first of all, we see, I think some of the time we see some of the golden rule coming through here. Do to others as you would want them to do to you. I think we kind of see that coming through. First of all, in the young cottagers who are letting their father eat instead of them. But also in Frankenstein here, once he realizes, like, oh, this is wrong and this is causing harm and causing more stress and causing more hardship on them, so I'm going to stop. He would want other people to do that for him, so he's going to do that for them. So we see here very like that he wasn't always the monster, which may be part of the overall lesson to learn from the story, that Frankenstein wasn't always the monster. The people, by treating him like a monster, he becomes a monster. By people treating him like a monster, he becomes a monster. So how are we treating others? How are we treating others? But I thought that was an interesting point to point out there, kind of that development of where he started from and kind of seeing some things within the golden rule there. But we also just see how lonely, so very lonely Frankenstein is. Again, a theme that we've seen throughout science fiction, loneliness, and that loneliness is not good, that we were not made to be alone, that we were not created to be alone, but we were created to be in a relationship, right relationship with God and right relationship with other people as well. Loneliness, not good, we are told in the scriptures very, very early on. Here's what Frankenstein's monster says. Hateful day when I received life, I exclaimed in agony, accursed creator, why did you form a monster so hideous that even you turned from me in disgust? God in pity made man beautiful and alluring after his own image, but my form is a filthy type of yours, more horrified even from the very resemblance. Satan had his companions, fellow devils, to admire and encourage him, but I am solitary and abhorred. So again here, we see Frankenstein's creature. We see his loneliness. We also see this here, people were made in the image of God, something that we've discussed here before, so we're not going to get into that then. People are made in the image and likeness of God. We are all image bearers of God, made in his image and likeness. And here, has Frankenstein created in his image and likeness? And what does that say about him and who he is as well? But we just see here this loneliness that Frankenstein has, that he can't reveal himself to anyone because of the way that he looks, because he'll be rejected, and because he, again, will just be chased off. And so he really is struggling with loneliness. And because he is struggling so much with loneliness, the creature, Frankenstein's monster, he demands that Frankenstein create him a female companion like himself. He wants to have a suitable helper, if you will. So we see this here, I think it's an allusion, a reference to the Adam and Eve story and how Frankenstein is looking for a companion, looking for someone who he can be in relationship and spend time with. Here's what Frankenstein says at the end of chapter 11. My companion must be of the same species and have the same defects. This being you must create. So, again, Adam found no suitable helper, so God creates Eve. So we have Adam and Eve. That's what exactly this reminds me of and what it's taken from, that Adam needed a suitable helper. And here, Frankenstein's monster believes that he needs a suitable helper. So he demands that Frankenstein create him a female companion. He believes that he has the right to happiness as somebody who has created this, and that Frankenstein owes him, that he owes Frankenstein's monster a female companion, that he is obligated to make her for him. That's what he wants. So again, here on here in chapter 12, we read, "Oh, my creator, make me happy. Let me feel gratitude for you, towards you for one benefit. Let me see that I excite the sympathy of some exciting thing. I do not deny me my request." Here again, we read later on in the same chapter, Frankenstein's monster says, "My evil passions will have fled." If he can just have this female companion. "My evil passions will have fled, for I shall meet with sympathy. My life will flow quietly away, and in my dying moments, I shall not curse my maker." So what we have here is Frankenstein's monster thinking that if he can just find the right person to be in a relationship with, that all of his problems will go away. What he's doing is placing his hope in a relationship of finding Mrs. Wright, the right person for him. And if he can just do that, then he'll be happy. Then he won't have these murderous intentions anymore. Then he won't be so angry. And he can just go away and live a peaceful life. And everything will be great if he could just find the right woman. Friends, he's placing his hope in the wrong place. Because even if Frankenstein were to have a female companion, Frankenstein's monster, if he were to have a female companion, Frankenstein's monster would still be with himself everywhere he went. Just having the right relationship wouldn't take away all the pain and all the sorrow and all the hurt. It doesn't do that. Those things just don't go away when we find the right relationship. So if you're placing your hope in, "Oh, if I could just find the right person, everything in my life will fall into place and be great," that's not the way that that works, because you're placing way too much upon that person. You're placing things upon that person that were never meant to be placed upon them. Oh, you know, what you're essentially doing is letting them take the place of God for you. God's the one who we can turn to be in a right relationship, to feel fulfilled, to have meaning and purpose, to be content and to have joy. God is the one who can give us those things. And if we are looking at another person saying, "You need to give me those," we're asking that person to do something that they were never meant to do and something that they can't do. So that is meant to, that is just destined to fail from the beginning, because we need to be looking to God as our source of you know, acceptance and love and joy and all these different things, and to be able to be forgiven and to be in right relationships and to be able to like ourselves and to take our guilt away and all these different things. That's the work of God. Now, again, being in a relationship with people is very important. We were created for relationships. Relationships with God and relationships with people. But if we are expecting people to do what only God can do, we're going to be let down. And we're not going to be let down by that other person. We're going to be let down by our expectations of that other person, because they will be doing, because we're going to expect them to do something that they can't do, that is only what God can do. But some people just think, if I can just find the right person, the right man or the right woman, if I could just find them, then everything in my life will be great. No, like, the one that we need to turn to be in right relationship first with is God. If we are not in right relationship with Jesus, then the other relationships in our life will not be right either. But first, it needs to start with being in right relationship with Jesus. But here, Frankenstein's monster thinks that if I could just find Mrs. Wright, everything in my life will be great. It will be perfect. But that's not the case. He's mistaken. He is looking for something. What he's looking for in the wrong place. And Frankenstein, he refuses this demand, that he's not going to do it, that he doesn't want to make this, that Frankenstein doesn't want to make something that is going to be like this, another creature that's going to be like him. He has no interest in doing that. But Victor does actually grant his request if he'll never have to see the monster again. So if he vanishes and if he goes away to the goes to another country, goes to the wilderness, if he never sees him again, that he'll grant this request. However, I'm not sure that Frankenstein really doesn't want to do it, and I'm not sure that he ever really truly has any intention of doing it. But he agrees to do it simply because Frankenstein's monster says that he's going to kill Victor's remaining friends and loved ones, and that he's not going to stop until he agrees to create him this female companion. So out of fear for his family, Victor reluctantly agrees. He agrees that he will create this female companion for Frankenstein's monster. And the creature, the monster, says that he's going to keep an eye on Frankenstein, that he's going to watch over him, that he is going to make sure that this happens, even though Frankenstein really doesn't want to make this, doesn't really want to create another one of these monsters. He agrees to do it out of fear of what will happen to his family if he doesn't. So we then go back to the book, and so as we go back to Victor's perspective, he has some great concerns over making this monster, and is truly having some doubts. And as he is thinking of this and having these doubts and wondering what he should do, his Frankenstein's monster comes to check on his progress, and then we see this dialogue between Frankenstein and his monster. Here's what Frankenstein says. "Begone. I do break my promise. Never will I create another like yourself, equal in deformity and wickedness." So here he's made a promise to do it, but Frankenstein's saying, "Nope, thought about it. I don't want to do it." And Frankenstein's monster replies with this, "Slave, I before reasoned with you, but you have proved yourself unworthy of my condescension. Remember that I have power. You believe yourself miserable, but I can make you so wretched that the light of day will be hateful to you. You are my creator, but I am your master. Obey." Oh, "You are my creator, but I am your master. Obey." Is this not sometimes what we do with God? That we are the ones who want to be the master of our own lives. We want God to do what we want him to do, when we want him to do it, how we want him to do it. We are the created, but yet sometimes we think or we act like we are the creator. So here Frankenstein's monster calls his creator a slave and tells him that he must obey him, or else what is going to happen? We can't really do that with God. We can't make those kinds of threats with God. We cannot do anything to God to make it so that he's not alive anymore or anything like that. We can hurt God, though, by our actions and our attitudes and what we say and how we treat people and who we are. That is painful to God when we do those things and they are sinful. So we can't hurt God in that way. But here it's just interesting to me that sometimes I think I see this attitude. Maybe it's not so straightforward, our attitude with this, with God, but we do have this kind of attitude when we say, you know I shouldn't do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. I know I shouldn't do this, but I'm going to do it anyway because I can do what I want, when I want, how I want. And we go, we do what we want to do, and we elevate ourselves above God in doing that. I think sometimes that we we want to be the Lord of our own lives, that we want to be in control, that we're the ones who want what we want. But for the Christian, Jesus must be both Lord, must be both Savior and Lord. Savior and Lord. He's the one who must be the Lord of our lives and what we do, and that we need to give control and surrender to him instead of trying to take that power and to try to take that control and try to make God be who we want him to be or do what we want him to do. We are the created and he is the creator, and we need to remember that. But there's this interesting switch here that happens between Frankenstein's monster and Frankenstein, where he thinks he's the one with the power. He thinks he's the one that has the ability to do all these different things. But actually, truly, he's even not. What he's doing is threatening his creator to be able to create someone else. So Frankenstein doesn't have the knowledge, doesn't have the power, doesn't have the ability. Frankenstein's monster doesn't have the knowledge, power, ability to create a being like him for him. Only Frankenstein can do that. Only Frankenstein can do that. So even though those roles really haven't reversed, Frankenstein thinks that he can somehow do something that's manipulative or threatening or whatever it may be, to get the creator to be who he wants him to be. I don't think we do this so obviously or so blatantly, but I think sometimes we do this where we want to be the Lord of our own lives, when truly that is the place that belongs to Jesus. I thought that was a really interesting conversation and something that would be worth mentioning. But Frankenstein here Frankenstein's monster makes a threat that terrifies Frankenstein throughout the rest of the book. He tells him, "I will be with you on your wedding night." Now, Frankenstein has become engaged again to his cousin Elizabeth. They are engaged. And that's the promise here of Frankenstein's monster. If you don't do this, I will be with you on your wedding night, Frankenstein believes as a threat. He thinks that's a threat to his own life, that he's threatening his life, that if you don't go and make a woman for me to marry and be happy with, that you're not going to get married, that I'm going to come and I'm going to kill you on your wedding night. That's the way that Frankenstein interprets that. So Frankenstein goes and still needs to at least then look like he's trying to make a female companion for Frankenstein's monster, because again, there's all these threats that are happening here. So what happens though is that Frankenstein needs to go to says that he needs to go to Ireland to be able to have all the right stuff that he needs and to be able to get this. So he moves away, trying to get some distance between himself and this creature and his family. So after Victor, Frankenstein is threatened by the creature again about this, you know, I will be with you on your wedding night. He decides that, you know, he really can't. He's made up his mind that even though this is a threat, even though it's upon his life, he just can't create another creature that is like Frankenstein. So he goes out to sea, goes out and sails out on a little boat to throw his instruments into the sea and to get rid of those. and then ends up falling asleep in the boat after he's kind of relieved. Like, he feels like a weight's been lifted off his shoulders. He got rid of these instruments, and now he really can't create somebody, you know, can't create a companion for Frankenstein as he for his monster, as he doesn't want to. And he falls asleep on the boat. He isn't able to come back to shore, but finally when they do, finally he gets back to shore. And when he lands, he's arrested for Clerval's murder. And Frankenstein's monster has strangled Clerval and left the corpse nearby where Frankenstein departed from the night before. So people had saw the boat and seen him and was there, and he's arrested for the murder of his friend. So here Frankenstein's monster has killed another one of somebody else who was very close with Frankenstein. However, Victor is, even though he is in prison for a little bit, he's shown to be innocent and is released and returns home with his father. His father comes to get him, and they return home from Ireland. He returns home with his father. Is now planning to marry Elizabeth, that they are engaged, that they're preparing to get married. And when the wedding day comes, Frankenstein knows that the monster is going to be around, that he's going to have to, and he believes he's going to have to fight him to the death. His wedding day comes. He has not made this female companion for him, so he believes that he is going to have to fight him to the death. So after the wedding, Victor goes and tells Elizabeth to stay and go stay in our room and lock yourself in there. I'm going to go. I got some things to do. And he thinks he's going to have to go and fight his monster to the death. I don't know why Frankenstein here. He seems to be a smart guy. I mean, has got some secrets, has reanimated, you know, people who were dead, has brought them back to life. I don't know why he would leave his wife alone on the wedding night when Frankenstein's monster is, it's not Frankenstein's monster goal to kill Frankenstein. It's his goal to make life miserable for him. So of course what happens is Frankenstein's monster goes and does not kill Frankenstein, but is already waiting in the room for Elizabeth. He hears a scream, but it's too late. Frankenstein's monster has killed Elizabeth. So Frankenstein tries to shoot him, but the creature escapes. And a few days later as well, Frankenstein's father also dies. So from seeing this, from, you know, he's now killed Frankenstein's monster has now killed his brother, a close friend, and his wife, and his dad dies a few days later after all of this. So Frankenstein has had his life ruined by his creation. Has had his life ruined by this. So he goes to seek revenge. He goes and pursues his monster. He is going to kill his own creation, is what Frankenstein wants to do. But of course, Frankenstein's monster stays ahead of him, and they get on a chase, and they're going all throughout Europe and up through Russia, and they get to an Arctic Ocean going towards the North Pole. And that's where Captain Walden comes back in again. So that's why he's on going towards the North Pole in the beginning of this book, because he is chasing his creation, and that's where Frankenstein's monster has led Frankenstein. So at the end of the book, what we have is we go back to Captain Walden and his perspective. He resumes telling this story, and so they're looking for Frankenstein, but they can't find him, and the ship has become trapped in an ice pack, and several members of the crew die, and the rest of Walton's crew decides that, you know, we want to turn around. I don't know why we're going up more north to try to catch this thing, because Frankenstein and Walton have become friends and explained what's going on, so Walton is allowing Frankenstein to try to pursue this thing, but they want to all go south instead of going north. Victor's not too happy about that. not too happy about what's going on, but he knows that that they probably do need to go south to be able to get away from the ice and to be able to actually survive. So, but Victor says that he, even if you guys turn around and go south, which, you know, you might need to do to save your ship when the ice breaks and all that kind of things, that I'm still going to go, that I'm still going to go after this creature because this creature must die. However, Victor is the one who shortly after that dies. And he tells Walton in his last words to seek happiness and tranquility and avoid ambition. Seek happiness and tranquility and avoid ambition. I don't think that's necessarily true in what you or great advice in what to do. Maybe seek happiness and tranquility, maybe to seek happiness and to be content in life. But to avoid ambition, I'm not so sure about that. But what Frankenstein has done is he has been very ambitious and with something that he wasn't aware of what it was. See, he thought that he could just recreate life, that he could bring something that was dead back to life, and he would receive glory and honor, and it would be great, and he would have all these different things, but it didn't turn out the way that he thought that it would. And I think that's maybe part of the story, the lesson here, too, is that to be cautious with what we are doing and how we are doing things, because sometimes things don't turn out the way we expect them to turn out. And it certainly is not expected. This was not expected for Frankenstein. But to avoid ambition, I don't think is good advice. It just depends on what we are being ambitious about. If Frankenstein sought out to truly cure disease so that people would be disease-free and so that people wouldn't have to suffer and all these different things, that's a pretty good ambition. But if he's seeking it to do it just for his own glory, that's not some great ambition. And if he's seeking to do it for the good of other people and not himself, he's probably not going to make an 8-foot monster and this horrifying-looking creature. He made him that way because it was easier for him, because that's what was best for him, and that's what could get him what he wanted, and that could get him the glory he was seeking. But if he was doing this and being ambitious and trying to do it for what would be best for others, then that might be something to be ambitious about. If we're being ambitious about spreading the gospel, we should do that as well. So I don't think this is necessarily great advice, but I understand why Frankenstein would offer it. Back to the book, and Walton discovers the creature, Frankenstein's monster, is on his ship, and it actually appears to be upset over Frankenstein's death because that... And now there's no chance. Not that there was a chance before, but there's no chance now that he can have this companion that that he was looking for. But Victor's death has not brought Frankenstein the peace. Frankenstein's monster the peace that he thought that it would. Now Frankenstein's monster says that actually what he's done has made him more miserable than Frankenstein himself ever was. Frankenstein's monster is more miserable with what he's done than Frankenstein is miserable with what has happened. The creature also says, again, here we get into another theme that we've seen throughout science fiction. Here's what the creature cries. Here's what we read here at the end of the book. But soon, he cried, the creature, with sad, solemn, and enthusiasm, I shall die. And what I now feel be no longer felt. Soon the burning miseries will be extinct. I shall ascend my funeral pile triumphantly and exult in the agony of the torturing flames. And he goes on from there. And then here's the closing lines. He sprung from the cabin window, and as he said this, upon the ice raft which lay close to the vessel, he was soon borne away by the waves and lost in darkness and distance. So what Frankenstein's monster is threatening to do here is self-harm, that he's going to go, that he is going to go and kill himself so that no one else will know of his existence, so that no one else will know that he's there, so that he can't hurt anyone, and so that he can be set free from these feelings that he is feeling. So again, we come to a familiar theme in science fiction as we have throughout this season, and that is suicide. So again, if you are struggling with thoughts of self-harm, of suicide, please, if you're listening in America, we have some international listeners who we are thankful for. You can look up the National Suicide Prevention Hotline in your own country. It's a pretty quick Google search for you. Just type that into the Google machine and you'll get there. Please, if you are struggling, if you are having these thoughts, please call somebody. So if you're in America, you can call 1-800-273-8255 and you can talk to somebody. You can actually have a conversation with them about this and what is going on. So if you are having these thoughts of self-harm, these thoughts of suicide, please, please reach out to somebody. Please call someone. Again, that number is 1-800-273-8255 to get the help that you need. And it's okay to seek help when help is needed. I encourage you to do that. Please, if you're struggling with these thoughts, give that number a call or talk to somebody in your life that you know and is trusted that can get you the help that you need, because Frankenstein's monster here thinks that this is the answer, thinks that this is what he needs to do, but he's wrong. This is not what's needed. It's the only way he sees out, but if he could have talked to somebody, maybe if he could have been, there are other ways. There are other ways. He should have sought the help that he needed. People are there, and they are willing and ready to help you, so please, if you need that, please seek that help. And get that help if you need that. And that does it for Frankenstein. As we have come to a close in the season one finale, as we have discussed topics such as creation, praising God and not being praised by people, somebody's playing God and playing God through science, and how Jesus suffered innocently and was killed, and how Jesus is our Redeemer, how God created us and loved us. We've talked about Jesus as Lord and much more. So that is all for season one. We've looked at 6 movies and 6 books. I would love to hear from you which one was your favorite and why. It would be great to hear from you and which one of these works you have enjoyed the most. You can reach out to me on Instagram and Twitter at Theology and Sci-Fi or Facebook. You can like Theology and Sci-Fi the podcast, or you can email me at theologyandscifi@gmail.com. So I'd love to hear from you. Which one of these 6 movies or 6 books has been your favorite? And what did you think of Frankenstein? Is there something that I missed? Something that you noticed that I didn't? I'd love to hear any of your thoughts and get your feedback on it. It would be great to hear that. Well, I encourage you to tune in next time for the first episode of Season 2, which will be on July 14th. I've got some things going on in June. As I said, some things going on this month and later on, so I'm just going to have to skip over an episode. But we'll be back on July 14th. I look forward to being with you then. We'll be looking at either a TV show episode or a short story. We're going to look at those for season 2. So same kind of format, same kind of deal, just switching up what we are looking at. And I am excited about that. Some great TV shows and great short stories to look at to get the theological themes and ideas from within them as we look at the beautiful genre of science fiction. Thank you so much for joining me today. Frankenstein was a good book. I truly enjoyed this. I think it's one that I'll return to again at some point just to read through and to be able to go back over that. So as always, you don't have to read the book to listen to the podcast, but if you've not read this book yet, I encourage you to go and get it and read it. It will be worth your time. Something that I really enjoyed. This podcast has also been something that I've really enjoyed, spending this time here being with you. Thank you for listening. I appreciate it so much. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I'll see you back here for season 2. For Theology and Sci-Fi, I am Derek V. Trout. I am already far north of London, and as I walk in the streets of Petersburg, I feel a cold northern breeze play upon my cheeks, which braces my nerves and fills me with delight.